My strong advice is to understand, first of all, the necessity to be very skeptical of the traditional media apparatus, which is ultimately owned by some of the largest industrial conglomerates in the world, strongly connected to other points of power. Work around it. Become your own media in practice, in small ways, in big ways, to keep your principles and sense of clarity on principles. What the Clinton campaign is doing at the moment is trying to say, well, okay, yes, maybe we're connected to arms dealers and to Saudi Arabia, and yes, maybe we subverted the integrity of the democratic primaries, et cetera, et cetera. But you will just have to swallow that. You will just have to swallow that, or else you'll get Donald Trump. That's a form of extortion. And one, it is. It is a form of extortion.
You have elicited applause, Julian.
You can't permit. It's very important not to allow the political process to suffer from extortion, or even yourself to be susceptible to extortion. That one says one has certain principles. If these principles are not followed, then there is a price to be paid. And that creates a standard and a general deterrent. And I think it is important for those people who feel that their principles have been violated in the way that the democratic primary process has been run, or how Chelsea Manning has been imprisoned for 35 years and tortured, or the Espionage Act crackdowns, or many other things, to go, okay, well, there's a cost to violating principles, even if there's also a cost to yourself, even if you don't like the risk, which seems to be getting very small, but the risk that Donald Trump becomes president, that one has to have a lion somewhere. Otherwise, as each election cycle proceeds, you are pushed further and further into the corner.
That's WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange speaking at the Green Party convention in Houston via video stream from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been holed up for more than 4 years. He was speaking with the Green Party's David Cobb. For transcript podcasts, more, go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is more talk radio with our host, Celeste Carey. Today's guest is Gabriel Hayden, who is teaching a class entitled Elegizing Black Lives for Portland Underground Graduate School.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You know you love KBOO's programming, but did you know you can help inform decisions about new programs on KBOO, support evaluating shows to ensure programming excellence, as well as help process feedback about shows from our listeners? Well, you can when you join the KBOO Programming Advisory Committee. All you need to be is a KBOO member. Attend monthly meetings on the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. at KBOO, and commit 5 hours a month to work on committee-related tasks. The Programming Advisory Committee works alongside KBOO programming staff to live out our programming charter. You can find out more at kboo.fm/committees. See you the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO needs you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the Cannabis Fair. Over 60 grows will be showcased this year, and there will be awards for the winning plants in several categories. Again, that's the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds, 2330 17th Street Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Running a little bit late this morning, so I think we'll listen to a little bit of Billie Holiday while we wait.
darling, it's grand. They just don't understand living for you. It's easy living, it's easy to live when you're in love, and I'm so in love. There's nothing in life but you. Of sorrow has taken you. Angels have no thought of ever returning you. Would they be angry if I thought of joining you? Gloomy Sunday. With shadows I spend it all. My heart and I have decided to end it all. Soon there'll be candles and prayers that are said, I know. Let them not weep, let them know that I'm glad to go. Death is no dream, for in death I'm caressing you. With the last breath of my soul, I'll be blessing you. Gloomy Sunday. That my dream never haunted you. My heart is telling you how much I wanted you. Gloomy
Strange fruit hanging Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, in the metro area, 91.9 in points east up to Hood River and beyond. In the south, it's 104.3, and everywhere it's KBOO.FM. Good morning. This is More Talk Radio. I'm your host, Celeste Carey, flying solo today. I hope, Cecil, wherever you are having a wonderful time. And I want to explain a rather somber setting of the scene today. We heard the Tricky remix, the artist Tricky remix of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. Our guest, and we're hoping that she will be able to make it here, will come and talk about how Black souls have been immortalized, and not necessarily those caught in heroic postures or exalted activities. No, these are Black souls that have been lost to racism, state death, senseless killings, things that when they woke up that morning, they did not anticipate. Well, unless it was a state-sanctioned killing. We'll be speaking with Gabrielle Hayden, and we're going to talk about a class that she is teaching at Portland's Underground Grad School. Our intention today is to talk about how Black lives are elegized and how the Black poets, authors, artists, singers have immortalized those who have lost their life in the senseless killing of lynching and state execution. And some of you may recognize that while Strange Fruit doesn't catch any one person, and hold them up to the intense scrutiny that art will give a situation or a circumstance, but it's as though it's talking about every person, as though the soul of every Black person who's been lynched because of racial violence and social ignorance, or we'll call it governmental sanctioned atrocity. It's a nameless person. It's someone who is like the unknown soldier in this case. And so we're talking about how this work sometimes put out just for the acceptance and the sharing by Black audiences, and then sometime later shared by other audiences, and then sometimes put out in front of the world, how it affects us, how the work has come together, why it is important, and what you can learn from it, regardless of your ethnic heritage. And standing in for the moment, as we give Gabrielle some time, we have Douglas Soy, who was a guest on our show last week when we talked about Portland Underground Graduate School and how exciting it could be to have different forms of knowledge serve not just the city, but to serve us here in the city. Let me give my engineer the high signal here and have him bring on Douglas. Are you with us, Douglas? Good morning. How are you?
I love talking to you, Celeste.
I like talking to you, too. I was looking for you last week, but I still had fun. I had fun, and I haven't met somebody. We have some distance and time between us, but there was no distance in mind at all. So I had a wonderful time. And, oh, I think I got the high sign that we have Gabrielle on the line as well.
You do. Thank you so much for having me, and sorry for the confusion about the time.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I saw it in one of the earlier emails, and I was hoping, okay, at 3 o'clock in the morning, will either one of us retain enough awake brain cells to make that connection? But now that I've got you both, first, Douglas, give us a little pitch about why you picked this class, and then Gabrielle, I'm going to ask you why you picked this subject, and then just kind of unfold this.
Sure.
So, Douglas?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I picked this course because, well, with everything going on in the news, there's a sense of, helplessness about what's going on in our cities with Black lives. And I just felt like PUGS was an alternative way to try and heal us. It was the thing that I felt like I could do to participate and lend support.
I totally feel you on this one. I think this is really timely. And I do echo that helplessness. What I hope we don't devolve to is a hopelessness. And I imagine that just about every person of color, not just Black, but people of color, because of the hateful rhetoric just floating everywhere in the air, is trying to hold it together, because even me, in the back of my mind, I keep having these panic attacks. And it's so crushing, because there is no safe posture. That's what I say. There's no safe posture you can assume to prevent any harm coming to yourself. I mean, a man in, I believe it was Baton Rouge, I'm not sure, who was a therapist, was laying on his back with his arms in the air, and he still got shot. And you have to interject, you know, some kind of wry and ironic attitude in it to even be able to hold your stomach together and say the words, because it's unthinkable. So what better thing to do than to take all of that raw pain and fear and kind of transmute it into something to stimulate the intellect and bring it up to the fore brain instead of the brain stem, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, I had taught these poems that we'll be talking about in this class before as, I'm sorry, someone is cutting down a tree next to my house. I had taught these poems before as part of a class where it was an introduction to poetry class, so in a much more kind of aesthetic way. But as I was thinking about what I could bring to a PUGS class, I thought about the power that they brought and the sense of movement and action that they that these elegies demand. So I just thought that they might speak in a very immediate way to these, to both the intellect and to the panic that you're describing. So one of the poems that we'll be reading by Langston Hughes called The Bitter River, I think really captures that. He says, "I've drunk at the bitter river with its filth and its mud too long, tired now of the bitter river, tired now of the pat on the back, tired now of the steel bars because my face is black. I'm tired of segregation, tired of filth and mud. I've drunk of the bitter river and it's turned to steel in my blood." And I think...
Oops. We still have you?
Oh. Yeah, you still have me.
Okay, good.
So this is an excerpt of a long poem dedicated to the memory of Charlie Lang and Ernest Green, each 14 years old, one lynched together beneath the Shubuta Bridge over the Chickasawhae River in Mississippi in 1942. And I think that what I love and admire about this poem is the way that it takes that grief and it takes these very classical elegiac tropes and brings them into a sense of action so that it makes space both for sadness and for loss and also for a sense of movement towards something changing.
I had a conversation with a young woman, I think it was last week, who is of Asian descent. She's mm-hmm. Filipino, and she was talking about a situation not ending and how do you keep going day after day. And another one of those sardonic moments, and you have to interject wry humor. And I said, well, this is how you do it. You do it just like those first slaves did it when they start praying for the end of slavery, not knowing it was going to be 400 years later. Yeah. And they hoped in some particle, some recess of some atom that it might be sooner. And when you say movement, you know, I'm thinking of this this grand, slow, languorous movement, kind of like a swollen, muddy Mississippi, that it's big, it's muddy, it's churning, but is it really moving anything forward, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, what's so interesting about this poem is the way that it asks that question, right? So the Chickasawhae River was where many of the people who lived were displaced along the Trail of Tears almost about 100 years before this lynching happened. And I think that you can see a kind of implicit allusion to that in the fact that this is the only poem where Hughes specifically named the place and the people. He has a lot of poems about lynching, but this is the one where he names the place in this very specific way. And then the theme of the poem is this: I'm tired of it. It's been going on too long. Stop telling me. You know, it's this theme that he talks about over and over again, that of like, you know, stop telling us to wait, tomorrow will be a better day, kind of. But I don't know.
Well, you know, I think it was not by accident at all that that was mentioned. You know, I grew up hearing about the Trail of Tears because my mom was Blackfoot. Her mother's mm-hmm. Blackfoot Indian, and so she told me a lot about that situation. And I think it's really important to mark that confluence between the descendant of African slaves and the indigenous First Nation people, because yeah. what you're doing is you're parting out two rivers of atrocity and you know, I'll take a word that's a little lighter, indecency, and displaying them. So, you know, you mentioned that you picked these two, you picked this particular way of presenting these poems. And it's interesting to me that you have hit something that is kind of like, it's a sacrament for Black Americans. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to know what kind of outcome were you expecting, because Gwendolyn Brooks did not really want white people reading her poetry. She did not give a damn. Okay. That's one of the few words I can use. That's one of the few. Yes. You know, and so, you know, and she knew implicitly and explicitly that white society was going to try to analyze and quantify and then qualify it. And so she thought, you know, in the parlance of a lot of Black kids on the schoolyard, forget mm-hmm. them. You know, forget y'all. So I'm knowing in my DNA why she didn't want or care. And then you have some folks who release their work with the hope, I guess, you know, that the world would read it and in some form, you know, be ashamed and, you know, have a mass mea culpa or something. And, you know, and recognize how, you know, what is going on. But I'm looking at the way, for example, racism plays out here in Portland, you know, uh-huh. and we talk about somebody being passive progressive, you know, and not getting it. And so what kind of outcome could you expect out of white students in this day and age denying, you know, the depth of the atrocity that American Blacks suffered? And what kind of consciousness do you hope to awaken within folks? Because I can see somebody just saying, yeah, right. Okay, that's a bunch of hooey, you know, and mm-hmm. I didn't have slaves anyway, so what's the deal?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, I think I have to be realistic. It's just a class. It's just going to be one part of a larger conversation. One thing that I am asking people to do is that if they are not already deeply familiar with it, to read the recent article in The Atlantic that offers a pretty good summary of the way that racism has played out in Portland in particular, and the way that redlining happened up through the 90s, so that, like, basically until the moment when gentrification happens, this sort of economic dispossession, like direct economic dispossession, is happening. And so I think that it's a lot easier to understand when you say to someone, look, like, how did your folks pay for college? Oh, because, you know, your grandma had money they bought a house using a federally insured loan, and then they sold that house when they passed away, and that paid for your college. Oh, that wasn't, you know, so it's like specific money that you had that allowed you to live in the world that was explicitly not made available to specific African Americans, including the ones in your city. But I also think, you know, another part of that question then is a lot of the people who have signed up are African American.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that actually in practice, this class is going to be a lot more about me learning from the students and the participants in this class and us having a conversation about the poems. Because what I really don't want is for this class to be, this class cannot be about making me or any white students in the class feel like, oh, we're doing good somehow by just reading these poems. No. Like, that would imply somehow that the poems aren't incredibly valuable works of literary mastery in and of themselves, or that we were somehow, that was enough. And that's, it's not a substitute for addressing these kinds of material things. I mean, what is Ruth Wilson Gilmore defines racism specifically as the state-sanctioned or extra-legal production and exploitation of group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. It's kind of a handful, but I think it really captures this point that this is about death, you know, in some real sense, even though maybe in polite Oregon it's about, like, you know, my friend being, like, snubbed in line at the bagel shop or something. I don't know.
You know, I this is one of those moments where real life impacts everything. Real life is just, you know, it just fell down like a heavy rain and it's covering everything with this oily residue. I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this again, as I said, is a sacrament, and I wonder how many folks are going to be able to hold themselves together, while having something that is precious and actually articulates the color, the substance, the texture of Black American blood on hands, and be able to function. Because as I listen to this, I actually have to disassociate myself from parts of me that are feeling, so that I can have a quote unquote intellectual academic conversation. Yeah. And then the truth of it is because this is so profound, it does deserve that intellectual conversation. But you're right, that cannot be enough. So now I'm going to ask another one of the hard questions.
Yeah.
So as a white woman, how do you feel you will be able to not only do justice to this sacrament, and I respect the fact that you're saying you're coming to learn as well, I'm hearing that, but you've got to actually, you've got to burrow through the programming that American whites have had to not feel or respond at all to the atrocities inflicted upon Blacks. So, you know, this calls for not just some academic stimulation. This calls for some real visceral and spiritual I don't want to say introspection, but it's got to be like an introspection, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No, it absolutely does. It absolutely, it's real. I mean, I don't know how to do that except to be present with the poems, because I think part of what they do is bring that sense. They invite you into those feelings, and also to be present with the feelings and experiences of the other people in the conversation. Because what I definitely don't want is to make people feel that it's too much, that they just have to dissociate from how real and present it is. And I guess in my own life, the other thing that the thing that really made me stop feeling scared to teach this class and sign up was a conversation I had with my sister. Her husband is Senegalese, and her two-year-old son is the only grandchild, the new generation, and he's so beautiful, and we are all so deeply in love with him. And she's working in Senegal now, and was just a conversation about how worried she is about what's been happening and what that means for her son. And I was like, okay, what are you going to do? Like, you say that you love this boy, and you do, and you sing to him, and you listen to him sing his ABCs, and what are you going to do to help keep him safe? And I don't think that this class is going to do anything to help keep him safe, but it's the first step in me starting to think about that. It's one of a couple steps I'm taking to start to try to think about that.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I am your host, Celeste Carey, flying solo today on More Talk Radio. I've got my guest, Gabrielle Hayden, who is going to be teaching a class at the Portland Underground Graduate School. We call the school PUGS. And she's going to be, how shall we say it? We're going to reverentially review and draw illumination from the poems and the work of Black American artists that elegize the lives of Black people who have been lost to lynching and state-sanctioned violence. And as the title of the class says, this is not your ABCs. This is not a primer. You must be in this class with your brain and your nervous system and your spirit fully engaged. And my thought is, being a part of this class is going to be extremely painful. But one of the things that I've learned, I've had the blessing of being a community organizer at various levels or an activist at various levels. And one of the things I have learned is, in the midst of the volcano or chaos or pain is where new hope and regeneration live. And yeah, that those are solutions. And like you, I am not assuming by any means that this is necessarily going to move that muddy water forward. But at the same time, people will have to realize, they will have to accept that this is a trying fire that's necessary for growth. And if they sign in and sign on, and you know, then they can't, like, later on say, oh, this is too much, no more for me, thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, here's one of the challenges that you would have whether you were Black or white or any other ethnicity. How are you going to address issues like people's belief in this, what is the nice way to say it? The myth of reverse racism, or the sacrilege of white fragility.
Yes. You know, this was something I dealt with a lot when I taught these poems at Reed College, because, you know, the course that I taught was a required course called Introduction to Poetry and Poetics. So it was a class about, like, you know, it was very generic, and, you know, I could have been teaching just Milton and John Donne, and I chose to focus on African-American poetry because I love it and I wanted to teach it, and because I felt like it was a something that should be more central in the curriculum. And, you know, I definitely had students, they were too polite to say explicitly those thoughts, because I was the teacher and I, you know, in that context, I was the authority.
Mm-hmm.
But they were almost all white, and I'm sure many of them did have those thoughts. But, and what I really communicated to them was, you know, in that context was, this is, you know, even according to that kind of, I think you could call it a kind of white supremacist ideology, these are just the best poems. These are just really amazing poems. And I don't get that far in the new world. This is, you know, just as, but I, you know, as I was saying to a friend who's an activist in Detroit, you know, it seems like kind of weak tea. I don't know. In the context, it seemed like that's what people wanted. They wanted to feel smart. And so it was like, well, if you really want to feel smart, you'll read these poems. But, and that was something. But I, you know, I think there's, it doesn't get at the underlying structure by which that is the only way to think about it.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking people missed a point if they want to be polite and, you know, smirkingly judgmental, because I'm thinking, I would have asked him, have any of you read like James Joyce, you know, maybe just one or two of the Irish poets? Because those who talk about the indenture of an entire country and culture hopefully would have got something. And, you know, maybe there would have been a point of intersection by the fact that it was white skin that was oppressing white skin, and they would have been able to, I don't know, maybe, you know, like empathize, you know, and then make a switch over to reading the black narratives and poetics, and maybe then be able to recognize not only the value of the artistry and the mastery of the word and imagery, but then understand why, you know, that for both of these cultures, these would be sacraments that you should read lovingly and with respect and with your, you know, your heart open, so that you can also not make those same spiritual mistakes, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, but it was those black people, those colored people wrote those poems, you know.
Well, and I want to defend my students because they were really wonderful, and I think they did open their hearts. But I also know from my own experience, being a young white person who grew up in boring Oregon, but there are many layers of what you have to learn.
That's true. And by the way, she means the city boring Oregon, I'm assuming, not
yeah,
the
do,
state
indeed.
Of being boring.
So, you know, you open your heart, you get an introduction, you learn some things. It's amazing. You know, I had there was a professor, a colleague of mine, at Reed, who would teach things about, you know, how Jesus was a Jew and how Paul was a Jew and how they thought about their Jewishness. And how they had trouble relating to, oh, well, if Jesus was the Messiah, you know, but he was essentially, you know, state-sanctioned violence against an oppressed group. I mean, the students, he says, every time I teach this to the students, it doesn't really matter the subject matter. Every time I teach this to the students, they're going to forget it, like, within 6 weeks, because it's so contrary not only to what they learned in Sunday school, but to what the whole culture believes, right? And so I think that, like, that's part of how racism operates, right? It's that it's just easier to forget somehow.
Well, that's because here's the problem with education. The vehicle of education is a narcoleptic, okay? And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who will argue with me, and I'm going to break it down and put it in plain English. The vehicle, the way
break
we transmit education is a sleeping pill. It is a sleep inducing state because we are not taught, as a rule, critical thinking. The structures of being able to analyze any situation, those are not given to us. And they're especially not given to you if you're not the right color, the right gender. And I hate to say this, white people, if you're not the right white. You know, well, see, and that's one of the ways I explain things to people, you know, because, you know, when I have to deal with I've done a lot of various forms of cultural sensitivity or anti-oppression or anti-racism or whatever, you know, conversations. And one of the things that I use to try to explain to white people, and especially white men who start trying to, you know, puff up about reverse racism and all that. And I said, no, you're not a target of reverse racism. There's no such thing because you got to have the right power to do that. But what you are is suffering from the point of intersectionality because in your particular silo, and that silo being the silo of male white American, regardless of your education or income status, you're expecting a certain amount of privilege. And it's not coming because the ones that are higher up, well, you know, they're educated better. They're from the right families. And therefore, you're not the right white. And so you feel oppressed because you didn't get your white boy grab bag goodies. You know.
No, and, that's absolutely right.
You know, and so I told him, I said, okay, think of how you feel not getting that due. Okay, especially if you tried to be a good person, play by the rules, get the best education your people could afford, and treat people right with the thought that in the back of your head, well, I know I'm white, but I want to be the right kind of person. And then you don't get anything. Okay, now think about how you feel. Okay, that's how the rest of us feel, magnified by, I don't know what, infinity. And so, and I try to get people to take that moment right there and jump into that empathy. Because if you don't have empathy, you can't learn jack. I almost said one of those seven deadly words that we're not supposed to say, you know, but you can't learn jack without empathy because I don't care what science says. If you don't engage the whole being, you didn't learn jack like you were talking about those students. I'm looking forward to this class. I'm looking forward to the transformation. I'm looking forward to sparks, but I'm looking forward to illumination and not just heat. And we do have one caller, and James, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I like that point that you made about education. There is that teacher, her name is Jane something, the lady who's famous for teaching racism to white students. I can't remember her name offhand, but she actually made a point that one of her grandkids was in a class learning about the teacher was teaching about how Native Americans had, you know, that the white folks were the peaceful ones coming to settle the frontier and the Indians were attacking them. And she told him about this Mormon massacre and asked her her teacher to tell her about it. I can't remember the name of it, but her teacher actually pulled her aside and said, well, if we taught you that, then it wouldn't teach you to be proud of America. You know, so she goes on this whole thing about how education isn't, like you said, it's not about critical thinking at all. And even in a lot of ways, it's not even about learning. It's about indoctrination and teaching you how to be a good American rather than being, like you said, a critical thinker. And I think that, you know, I only heard a little bit so far about this class that's going on, but I think that, you know, these things are sorely needed. I mean, they had that teacher down there in Arizona who got canned for teaching the Mexican-Americans, the Mexican heritage class because, you know, and even though that it was teaching truth, they had a hard time with it because it put the founding fathers in a terrible light because you're not just seeing them as, you know, these great thinkers and great and, you know, great doers in creating America. You're seeing them in their racist light as well. So it's a lot about trying to hide that, but they overlook the whole fact that because you were giving these Native students and these Mexican students a place giving them to understand where they fit in the spectrum, the graduation rates were actually higher because now they understood a bit more about themselves in context to what America and how it was founded. So
when you make a valid point, a valuable point too, and I want to point out something additionally, since we're trying to peel back layers of indoctrination, and that is to say, and I know some people are going to try to parse out, you know, whatever kernel they can of me being wrong and hold it up, but I just want to say this for the record: Indigenous Mexicans, they're Native American. And I say that because I like I said, I'm part Blackfoot and then on my father's side Algonquin, and then on my father's side also Irish. And I'm sitting up here knowing from having met a lot of First Nation people, especially when I lived in Lawrence, Kansas, and they had what was called at the time Haskell Indian Junior College. You know, it's got a better name now. And talking to all of my friends, and, you know, and people forget Mexico is part of North America. And so whether you are Incan or Mayan or whatever, you know, if you are from either one of these continents and you're indigenous, you are a Native American.
Yes, very true, very true. I always seem to, I don't know, it's always like I always seem to have to make, I don't know, it just, it people get confused. I totally understand.
They do.
My family's from Mexico, you know, uh-huh. So it's like I tell people, you know, it's, I mean, you know, it just makes more sense because you can't, people don't understand when you say, well, you know, Mexicans are Native Americans. Like, no, they're not. They're from Mexico. Like, can I show you the map before the Louisiana Purchase? Can we go to that map, please? Because, you know, Mexico had a lot more territory into North America than
yes,
most people
realize. Yes, it did. So, well, thank you for your call. Thank you for bringing another perspective to this conversation. And thank you for being a listener of KBOO and More Talk Radio, James. So, Gabrielle, I want to thank you so much for the interview. It's not quite the way we had hoped, but I think it's everything we needed it to be. And when does your class start?
It starts this Wednesday. It's 4 Wednesdays, 6 to 8 p.m. at People's Food Co-op.
All right.
If you want to sign up, just Google Portland Underground Graduate School or Pugs PDX and shoot me a line, and we'll
go from there.
Sit you in. Yeah.
All righty. This is your community connection, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Official. Guess Who's Coming to Radio is now 3 hours. Every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m., we will continue to use the airwaves as a tool of positivity, awareness, and proactivity. We have a platform, and we intend to use it to encourage liberation. Many of us in the struggle for African liberation need a positive soundtrack, So music and words, which feed the mind, body, and spirit,